This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the next big thing in anti-inflammatory supplements, a brand new all-natural daily preventative against a host of possible inflammatory issues. Black for Health liquid extract from Future Farm Botanicals. Black for Health combines four plant-based foods, black garlic, black radish root, black cumin seed, and black peppercorn, containing high levels of body-ready healing botanicals. Black for Health supports your liver, skin, cholesterol, blood pressure, and weight management, circulation, and immunity. It's a tasty supplement with liposome complex for optimal absorption. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's myfuture, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. I'm very excited to bring you this podcast because it's all about sugar and the perils thereof, but also what you can do about it. The book is entitled Sugar Proof, The Hidden Dangers of Sugar That Are Putting Your Child's Health at Risk and What You Can Do. And our guest is Michael Gorin, PhD. He's the co-author of the book, along with Emily Ventura. He is really wonderfully situated to write this book because he's a professor of pediatrics at USC, University of Southern California, program director for diabetes and obesity at the Sabin Research Institute, co-director of the USC Diabetes and Obesity Research Institute, over the last 30 years, his research has focused on the causes and consequences of childhood obesity, which is a big, big problem. And his book is a wonderful deep dive into this subject. Parents, grandparents, you got to get this book. I mean, it could just really be a critical life-saving intervention for your kids and your grandkids. So what prompted you to write Sugar Proof, Dr. Gorin?
Yes, thank you so much for that lovely introduction and for having us on the show today. It's really a pleasure to receive the invitation and to be able to be here today, so thank you.
My pleasure.
So, yeah, there were several different motivations for writing the book, one of which was, as you mentioned, so I've been at the forefront of this research for 30 years, and there's a lot of important stuff happening in research, and we have a lot of great tools, and essentially I wanted to translate those for the general audience of families everywhere, because not just that obesity is a big problem, but kids' nutrition is a big problem, where kids are surrounded by sugar. 70% of processed foods have added sugar, 80% of kids' snacks. So we're living a real-life candy land almost. Every turn we're making, every place kids are going, they're presented with more opportunities for sugar. So I wanted to make that science more generally available. We had lots of kind of aha moments that we can talk about that kind of brought the story together. And we wanted to make these tools generally available. There's a lot written about sugar. Not a lot of it is about kids, and it's all kind of spread out all over the place. So we also wanted to have a comprehensive one-stop shop of the science and the how-to all in one place.
Well, indeed, you brought it all together in this book. And when it comes to the effects of sugar, we know that there's an epidemic of obesity among young kids. More and more kids are weighing in as overweight or obese, something that is historically without precedent. But what other consequences are there of excess sugar consumption? Because you actually cite some examples in the book of kids who seemed ostensibly, you know, normal weight, you know, maybe they were just a little chunky, but they just seemed, you know, like husky kids, who actually had pretty profound problems related to sugar.
Yes, and the effects of sugar on kids' bodies can essentially run from head to toe throughout the body and have different effects in kids' bodies than adults, which we can also talk about in more detail, and that's because sugar affects development. affects developing organs in different ways that we talk about in the book. And these could be kind of external outward problems that would be more obvious, like excess weight gain or tooth decay, but also a lot of under the skin, slowly evolving problems like long-term risk for chronic diseases, like type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease and cardiovascular disease, which are long-term chronic diseases, but are all seated in childhood, if not before, actually also during gestation. So these are all almost asymptomatic and don't show up until young adulthood or later adulthood, but they can all be tied to excess sugar, and that kind of slowly developing chronic diseases all begins in childhood. And then there's the other developmental aspects, such as effects on learning and memory and even academic performance, kind of more subtle effects that you might not be necessarily medically concerned about, but there is evidence suggesting, for example, that excess sugar consumption in childhood relates to compromised academic function on standardized test scores.
And conditions like attention deficit disorder, sleep disturbances you describe in the book as well, childhood depression and anxiety may be exacerbated by being on a blood sugar roller coaster.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's very hard to draw a direct line in terms of cause and effect of sugar, but certainly sugar is associated with those conditions and, as you say, can exacerbate those situations as well. And a lot of it ties to what we describe as the sugar roller coaster, which is the natural ups and downs in blood sugar that occurs when you eat a high sugar or high carbohydrate meal. And kids aren't able to regulate sugar as well as adults, so helping them regulate blood sugar as best you can through what they're fed can be very helpful to try and stabilize that blood sugar level.
So what insights have you gained as founder of the Childhood Obesity Research Center at USC looking at kids? Are kids presenting in clinics out there in Los Angeles with fatty liver, with a type 2 diabetes, with problems that previously we thought only adults were susceptible to?
Yeah, we unfortunately see a lot of those kids in our clinics at Children's Hospital and in our studies that we perform there as well. I mean, these are fatty liver disease wasn't even a disease 10 years ago in adults or children. Most liver disease was caused by excess alcohol. But now most fatty liver disease is related to sugar consumption and fructose in particular, and it's now called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is increasing rapidly in children and adults. It's a very serious problem. Left unchecked can result in liver damage and ultimately need for liver replacement. Same is true for type 2 diabetes. The age of onset is becoming younger and is now, when I started in this research in the 80s and 90s, there was no observation, there was no records of type 2 diabetes. It used to be called adult onset diabetes.
AODM, we just simply abbreviate it that way because it was, you know, children would get type 1 diabetes, you know, the autoimmune type, and then adults later on, if they got fat, you know, they would get the type 2.
Well, that's now around the year 2000, in the early 2000s, we started seeing increased reports of type 2 diabetes in children and teenagers. And now it's increasing rapidly, and pre-diabetes as well, which is kind of the subclinical prerequisite of type 2 diabetes. And now estimates suggest that 1 in 3 children born today will get pre-diabetes, and that would be 1 in 2 for Hispanic children and African-American children.
Yeah, and apropos of that, you know, COVID-19 is shining a spotlight on inequities in healthcare. What is said to be structural racism, you know, a societal imperative that puts minorities at higher risk of COVID-19 and other what are called NCDs, non-communicable diseases, you know, these degenerative diseases, heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, kidney disease, and so on and on. And is what you're finding, and you know, you work at USC, because I'm from Los Angeles. USC hospital system deals with, you know, a very diverse population, you know, affluent mm-hmm. kids, but also kids in the inner city. Are you seeing this as a phenomenon that's related to poor diets that may be uniquely associated with economic disadvantage or cultural factors or just food deserts?
Yeah, it's all related. Some of it's hard to tease apart, but for sure, our research over the years has shown major economic disparities in childhood obesity. For example, in Los Angeles, the rates of obesity in children are 7 times higher in low-income neighborhoods versus more affluent neighborhoods. And, you know, whether that's to do exactly with food deserts and poor diet is hard to exactly tease apart, but that's certainly a major candidate. And the other aspect of it, often overlooked, also coming from some of the research we've done in those populations, is that the Hispanic children and African American children, for example, are more insulin resistant than Caucasian children. And we don't really know the reason why that is.
And there may be a genetic programming that's part of that.
It could be genetic. It could be just underlying physiological differences in how body fat is stored and where it's stored. For example, Hispanics tend to accumulate a lot more liver fat, and fatty liver can contribute to insulin resistance. That's just one clear-cut example. So, and then kids going through puberty are also more insulin resistant. So the more insulin resistant you are at an early age, the more likely you are to be hyperglycemic, and the more hyperglycemic, high blood glucose you have, studies show you're more at risk for COVID complications. So some of this may explain why these by Hispanic and African American children are at higher risk for COVID complications. So unfortunately, it is all related and can be explained partly by physiology and partly by environment.
Well, right. There's that nature versus nurture argument, genetic programming versus epigenetics, the shaping by the environment. And is it possible that, you know, certain groups or certain nationalities or certain families have what are termed thrifty genes, and they may thrive under conditions of, you know, lots of physical activity and relative deprivation. But when they, you know, arrive on the threshold of the 21st century, you know, with abundance and, you know, lots of devices to constrain your physical activity, and now with COVID-19 lockdown, things are worse, that it kind of makes them more vulnerable to the effects of all that excess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the same principle really for sugar. And the perfect storm for sugar is kind of along those same lines. And that is a combination of three factors. First of all, babies and kids have a higher preference for sweetness. It's just something we're born with because mm-hmm. it was supposed to be protective from an evolutionary perspective. It was supposed to favor liking of breast milk, which is great, and it still does.
It's a survival mechanism.
It's a survival mechanism. It's also supposed to deter kids from crawling around on the forest floor and eating something toxic. Mm-hmm. That's the protective mechanism, but that's backfiring in today's environment. And this is true for all infants and all children, regardless of economic group or ethnic group, is that kids aren't crawling around on the forest floor. They're crawling, you know, they're in the grocery store, which...
in the grocery store aisles. They're in the shopping cart grabbing for the Count Chocula.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. 70% of what they grab for, and 80% of foods specifically targeted to children, because the food industry knows this, and so they specifically design foods to have more sweetness because they know kids will like it and want more of it. So that's what they're grabbing for. So that's the first two, built-in preference for sweetness and an environment that's loaded with sugars. But then the third aspect is their physiology, and that's this to me was the big aha moment, was the way different sugars are interacting with fundamental aspects of growth and development that cause lasting problems in the body. And I can, we can talk about specific examples, but those are the three major elements of what we call the perfect storm.
Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this vital message with you. Naturally occurring black pigments in vegetables, spices, and seeds have been found to have powerful anti-inflammatory effects. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I'm excited about what I think may be the next big thing in anti-inflammatory supplements, a brand new, all-natural daily preventative against a host of possible inflammatory issues. Black for Health liquid extract from Future Farm Botanicals. Black for Health combines four plant-based foods, black garlic, black radish root, black cumin seed, and black peppercorn, containing high levels of body-ready healing botanicals. Black for Health supports your liver, skin, cholesterol, blood pressure, and weight management, circulation, and immunity. It's a tasty supplement with liposome complex for optimal absorption. For more information or to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's myfuturefarm, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you with great shows like this one with Dr. Michael Gorin. There's a new joker in the deck of cards, which is fructose. Now, fructose is ubiquitous in the environment. You know, you get some fructose when you eat an apple. You know, fruit is a natural source of fructose. But fructose is appearing in the human diet only as of the past half century or so, and it's making a colossal contribution to the caloric quotient of children, right? And it has unique yes. properties as opposed to even, you know, classic Coke, regular glucose or sucrose.
Yes. So just a quick fundamental on sugar chemistry, just because it's important to know the differences. Sucrose, which is regular white sugar, is a molecule of glucose connected to a molecule of fructose. Fructose is the main sugar found in fruit. But in what the studies are now showing is that high amounts of fructose, especially when it's in high amounts and in free form, not the kind of form you would get from eating an apple. So eating an apple, which is high in fructose, is perfectly fine because there's a smaller amount of fructose and it's released very slowly. Mm-hmm. But when you drink a glass of apple juice or drink a glass of soda made with high fructose corn syrup, it's a very different scenario. There's a ton more fructose, and that fructose is free in solution. And what the research is now showing is that under those conditions, the fructose overwhelms the normal metabolic capacities because we weren't built, as you said, we weren't built to expect large amounts of fructose coming in free form. We were designed for small amounts coming in from natural fruits. So listeners are probably familiar with high fructose corn syrup, which is now used as the main sweetener in most sodas. But that's not the only high fructose-based sugar. We're now seeing a bigger proliferation of other fructose-based sweeteners, such as fruit juice concentrates, mm-hmm. apple juice concentrate, grape juice, evaporated grape juice. These are just basically—
And they sound natural. Please, I mean, look, they sound wholesome.
And it's right? And it's a great— It's great for the food industry because they can sell those as healthy-sounding sweeteners. But in fact, those are nothing more than high fructose syrups from fruit. So it's basically just taking this the liquid out of fruit and boiling it down the same way as you would make sugar from cane juice. It's just making sugar from fruit juice, the same basic mechanism, just boiling it down to create the sugar or the sweetener. And again, in large amounts, in free form, very problematic for a number of different reasons. And so for me, the realization was not just that kids are consuming more sugar, but they were consuming different types of sugar. And it's the different types of sugar that are problematic for growth and development.
And what's interesting is that, you know, I think a lot of people recognize that sugar's not great for you, so they may not use, you know, the sugar shaker or the sugar bowl on their breakfast table. But the revelation in your book is that there's so many Trojan horses for sugar. In fact, it's difficult to go to the market and obtain a product, products designed for kids, that doesn't have some added sugar, right?
Yeah, like I said, if you just randomly selected from the grocery aisle, 7 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 products would have some form of added sugar, and the food industry has gotten very clever at disguising them, like we just said, with healthy-sounding names or breaking. It used to be that people would just look at the first two ingredients and look for sugar, but now the food industry will use multiple types of sugar so they can break it down and kind of bury it in the ingredient list in lower amounts. So consumers have to be really savvy to look on the ingredient list to see what's there. And oftentimes they can be billed as healthy sounding sugars. So got to be really careful. And if we can identify, and part of what we're seeing in Sugarproof is we just need to kind of, it's easy to, you can learn to identify and substitute those hidden forms of sugar. Let's say, whether that's your peanut butter that you regularly use, or the pasta sauce, or the salad dressing. It just takes a little bit of detail to find an alternative product that does not have the added sugars, and that it's in itself can be very helpful and go a long way into reducing your sugar footprint.
Exactly. What we want to do is, I mean, we're not talking about an absolute prohibition. I mean, kids are kids and birthday parties being what they are and, you know, school outings and so on, if they ever resume. But what we can do is we can, you know, exert some discretion when it comes to selecting products that are, you know, within our family's control.
Absolutely.
Kids can utilize. You talk in the book about, you know, that it really starts early. Pregnancy programming of childhood sweet preferences and obesity. So it actually matters when you're pregnant what you eat. It can influence the child for a lifetime.
Correct. As well as when you're breastfeeding. So I mean, I'm a big, you know, breastfeeding obviously is critically helpful and important if you're able to, but what you're eating and drinking while breastfeeding can also make an impact. So it's not trying, you know, the intention is not to shame anybody, but to be aware that there can be transmission of sugars during pregnancy and during lactation, and basically can so that preference for sweetness that babies are born with, basically studies show that can be amplified and ramped up. So you can basically kind of highlight that, and babies will be born with an even higher preference for sweetness if they were exposed in utero or during early feeding. And it's not just, you know, breastfeeding. Obviously there's transmission, but now there's formula as well. You have to watch out for formula, because a lot of formula now can have added sugars or things that are disguised.
Which shouldn't be, because breast milk has a sugar. It's called lactose, right? But
yeah.
there's no fructose or sucrose in human breast milk. I mean, unless it's transmitted because a person has high blood sugar.
So lactose is another sugar that's similar to sucrose. It's two sugars joined together. It's glucose again joined to galactose, a different sugar. So there's, as you said, there's no fructose naturally in breast milk, but our research shows that if the mother is drinking high fructose beverages,
like sodas, you know, having a Coca-Cola,
yes,
which is a double whammy because it's a lot of caffeine as well.
Right? Yes. So our research shows that the fructose can be transmitted into the breast milk and therefore into the infant. So, and there's ways you can still have hydration and beverages you know, if you are lactating or pregnant, but just watch out for the fructose content in particular.
Indeed.
Because the glucose is not transmitted in the same way. It seems to be specific to fructose.
Okay. All right. Well, look, we've laid down the groundwork for our discussion of the hidden dangers of sugar that are putting your child's health at risk. The book is entitled Sugar Proof. And in part two, we're going to talk about sugar proofing, what you can do as parents and grandparents to have an impact on your child's health. It's not too late to turn things around. The horse is not out of the barn preventing your child from succumbing to the very, very serious lifetime effects of excess sugar consumption. When we return, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Michael Gorin. He's a PhD professor of pediatrics in the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California, with a lifetime of research on the problems of childhood obesity and diabetes. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.